How you been?
Good. I apologize that I can't speak Spanish. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure there's translation somewhere around here.
I'll try and speak English with an accent. Maybe that'll help. No, I'm just kidding.
How's the studio going? How's Blur going?
Studio in Los Angeles has been around for about 27 years, mostly animation. We have about 150 employees, and I guess the biggest thing we've done is Love, Death, and Robots is our show.
Which is an amazing
thank you.
Series that goes on Netflix, and it's got two seasons, right?
We're starting season four right now.
You're going on season four already?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. How did that project come about? Let's talk a bit about Love, Death, and Robots.
Most of these people are aspiring filmmakers or filmmakers.
Most likely, right? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Everybody thinks that in Hollywood, or for people like, say, David Fincher, who is one of the greatest filmmakers alive today.
Definitely.
And they think it's easy to get projects made for people like that. But David and I tried to do a heavy metal film.
I know.
For, I shit you not, fucking 12 years.
Why did that not happen?
Hundreds of meetings, and nobody would pay for it. It was a $50 million film. I know that sounds like a lot, but in Hollywood, that's not. And we had David Fincher, Guillermo del Toro, Jim Cameron, right. Zack Snyder, David. I was a drag on the ticket, but I was there. All going to direct pieces for $50 million. But we couldn't get anybody to do it.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
I
we
really
went to
can't
every studio,
that.
Every studio, every person with money, and it's because you guys might know this, but in the film industry, they're very risk averse. So if you need that much money, they want to see that other films like that have been done and made money. So if you want to do adult animation anthology, there's really nothing that they can point at that says, yeah, there's other films like that and they made money. So without that, it's really hard to get people to take a risk. Until Netflix happened, and David had this relationship with Netflix, so he just went in there and said, we want to make something like Heavy Metal, and we'll call it Love, Death, and Robots. And Netflix said, yeah, okay.
When did this happen? When did Netflix say, let's go? When did David Fincher call you and say, you know what, I think we're going to pitch this and we're going to, it's going to happen?
It was the weekend that Deadpool came out.
Okay.
So Deadpool came out, and that weekend was really, it did much better than anybody thought. So I'm sitting at home having breakfast, and David calls me and says, hey, your movie's doing really well, motherfucker. So we're going to use your new popularity to go and get Heavy Metal made. And I said, okay. And then we tried again and couldn't do it. And then he said, fuck it. We're just going to go to Netflix and they'll do it, which we did. And then it became Love, Death, and Robots.
What was the idea behind Love, Death, and Robots, aside from, of course, the reference and the, which is to some of us kind of evident on what heavy metal was back in the 80s, you know?
Right. Well, I'm very old.
No, you're not.
Yeah, I'm very old, yes. 58, which is it's a great
age. You don't
age.
Look it, man.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you. He's a young Willem Dafoe. That's what I think.
I get that all the time.
Well, it's true. The back in the 80s, Heavy Metal, this movie Heavy Metal came out, and it was an adult anthology animated thing. And I wanted to be an animator. I still love animation. I still do animation. But I don't want to do kids shit, right? I don't want to do dancing animals. Not if any of you do dancing animal films, I'm completely cool with that. But I don't want to do it. And so I saw this Heavy Metal movie, and I'm like, fuck, that's what I want to do. And so I really, really wanted to do a project like that. And so David said, oh, I do too. We can experiment. We can do different styles of animation. We can have different directors. We can have different kinds of stories. And so it was really like a way to test different things, you know.
How'd you pick the directors? Like, did you just sit down and work on storylines and said to some directors, hey, I think this would be a good fit? Or,
well, we've done 36 different stories, more in production now. It'll be 48, and 44 of them are stories that I read a lot. If any of you, like, I think reading is my superpower. So I love stories and I read all the time. So I found all these short stories that I thought would be really interesting short films. There's four that aren't. Two of them by one of the best, this amazing Spanish filmmaker named Alberto Mieglo. He did The Witness and this other one called Jibaro. That's really amazing. But so I find them, and then we kind of develop the story at Blur, and then we find a director who we think may have a vision for it, or an animation company that may do a style that we think fits the story.
Cool. There's one in one of the last seasons, I think. It's like one of the most hilarious things I've ever watched. It's the zombie apocalypse one.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Where'd you get that one from?
That one was one of the unoriginal. That was an original one. One of the four that original ones.
That was just amazing.
Thank you. That's one of my favorites, too. It's called Night of the Mini Dead.
And the little fart at the end, it just cracks you up every time.
These two directors at a company called Buck did that, and it was great. But that, in particular, came from... Blur does a lot of video game, work in the video game industry, and there was a game called Dead Rising. And they came to us and they said, we want you to do a cinematic for Dead Rising, and we want it to be really memorable. And so we came up with this idea. We were going to do tilt-shift photography and do a whole zombie apocalypse in tilt-shift. And we thought it was the best fucking idea we had ever had. And I go into this meeting to pitch this idea, and you get this feeling like, oh, my God, I'm going to give them this idea that's just amazing. They didn't like it at all. They thought it was, and they're like, nah, it didn't sound very interesting to us. And I'm like, no, it was going to be really great. But they didn't want to do it, and so we did something else. And I just took it and I filed it away. But I always wanted to do it because I thought it was really funny.
It seems as though most of the ideas that you come up with get rejected at the very beginning. You know, like, did Deadpool get rejected?
Every project I've ever done has been rejected multiple times.
That is crazy.
But it's common. I was at an industry function talking to David Fincher, again, you know, greatest living director. And there's another, we were talking about different projects that haven't happened. And another director who was new in the business was listening to us, and he said, can I just interrupt you guys to say, I don't know if I should be depressed or relieved that you have trouble getting projects made too, not me really, but David Fincher, right? Because it's a struggle, you know? And so it's easy to say, well, this project didn't happen because I don't have enough experience. That's depressing enough as it is. But when you realize that it's hard for everybody to get a project made, maybe that makes you feel a little bit better,
yeah.
Right?
It's also very interesting because, as you mentioned, heavy metal, I remember going through the magazines and, you know, wanting to understand a bit of that alternative animation world as well, and thinking about it as a kid. I must have been 8 years old or 9 years old when I first saw the heavy metal concept, and saying, I wonder if this is ever going to be a mainstream kind of thing, you know? And it seems as though happens with the comic universes today, where you would say that 35, 40 years ago, it would have been inconceivable to see this as a major industry source of money making,
yep.
You know?
Yep. I think that if your question is, how did that happen?
Yeah.
I think video games are the cause.
The reason?
Really? Yeah. I mean, look at video games. It's all animation, right? And most of them tell adult stories. I'd put in quotation marks. I mean, some of them are very, very sophisticated, like The Last of Us, which, if you haven't watched it on HBO, is a really good show. But everybody, we've had a whole generation that grew up playing, basically watching adult animation and interacting with it through video games, and I think it sets people love what they discover in their youth and as they're maturing. And so we have a whole group of people now who are older film and television consumers that grew up on adult animation through video games, and it made it possible. And then there's also just the fact that nobody did it. And so because nobody did it, they don't know that it can be done, and they think it can't be done. But then as soon as you do it, like Deadpool took 6 years of me begging.
That's crazy. Yeah. But it's understandable, though, because another thing that I would like to compliment regarding how the industry has to become mainstream is the fact that, you know, when I was a kid growing up, it wasn't cool to be a comic book collector, you know? I didn't feel really cool.
And it wasn't cool to be a nerd. Yeah.
It was considered very nerdy.
Yeah.
You know? If you liked those kinds of things, you would...
It still is, but if you go to Comic-Con or any of the, I'm sure they have, what's the South American version of?
In Colombia, we have one that's called SOFA, the Hall of Fantasy. And
does everybody go and they dress up and
cosplay? Yeah, they do cosplay and stuff.
Yeah, Comic-Con is like 180,000 people. It's right. Like hardcore.
And it started being like a Star Wars gathering, wasn't it? Or Star Trek?
You know, I don't know. I've gone 27 times to Comic-Con. That's like when I first moved to Los Angeles back in 1990 or so. And I go every year, but it was much smaller and it was much easier to go. I liked it a lot better when it was smaller. When you felt like you were part of an exclusive club, but now everybody loves nerdy comic book shit.
And it's hard getting tickets. Actually, I was watching an interview that you did when you were promoting the first season of Love, Death, and Robots, and you mentioned something your dad wrote to you once in one of a few letters that he wrote to you. Said, if you're trying to be cool, it will prevent you from being cool because...
Did I say that in an interview?
Really cool people don't have to try. Words to live by your father.
Yes.
And I related with that. I related to that. I was like, I was never cool. Were you cool?
I was never cool. No, I was a nerd. But I also played soccer, so I could hang out with the jocks occasionally. And then I liked books, so I would hang out with the nerds. But I failed high school, basically. But I was never cool. I could never decide what group I was supposed to be in, which was, in hindsight, better, I think. I mean, I had friends in every group. Not a lot of friends because I read too many books, but...
and you also wanted to be a comic book artist, right? And you actually moved to New York to try and get a job at Marvel Comics, and you didn't get it.
I didn't, yeah. I failed.
Why?
Because it's just hard. It's hard to get your foot in the door. Before I forget, though, I found another... my father's dead. He's been dead for like 10 years, but I found another... letter he wrote to me last year that I had just come out, maybe it was around 1998 or something, and I had a meeting with Jim Cameron back then, and he asked me about a film I had done, a short film, and we were going to work on a project of his. And we started talking about books, and I said, yeah, I'm developing this book. And he's like, oh, I love that book. Let's develop it together. And it was like, imagine Jim Cameron, like one of the best filmmakers ever, saying to a young filmmaker, yeah, let's develop a book, a science fiction movie together. It was like the air was sucked out of the room, and the sound was echoey, and I thought I was going to like hyperventilate. It was an amazing moment. You know. And then a week later, his producer called and said, yeah, I know Jim said that, but we're not going to do it, so fuck off. which was really cool. But anyway, my dad, I wrote my dad, and I said, oh, yeah, I had this moment. And he goes, oh, I hear he's a giant asshole. Should never work with Jim Cameron. Everybody knows in Hollywood that he's a giant asshole. I come from the other side of the country, so why my dad would know that Jim Cameron was an asshole was...
Where was he from, your dad?
Washington, D.C. I grew up there.
Okay.
Not a filmmaker or anything. But.
So how did he know?
I guess it was universally known that Jim Cameron was a tough gentleman.
And is he?
Yes, he is.
What was it like to work with
We get along. We get along
Terminator
okay.
Baby.
Okay now, but it was tricky, which has been widely reported.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I didn't see that anywhere.
You didn't do that research?
I didn't do that research about your relationship with James Cameron.
Maybe you should ask Natalia about that.
Yeah,
Natalia?
I did.
Natalia,
I asked her, and she told me a little bit about it. But what was it like to work, aside from... the fact that it's Jim Cameron who came up with the idea to work on a franchise of that size, you know, and the reputation that it has. What was it like for you?
it's so surreal that I can't, it's hard to describe that, because, I mean, you...
How old were you when Terminator came out? I'm sorry.
In the theaters?
Yeah.
Fuck. What
that was like 79, 80?
No.
Must have
maybe
been. 84?
That sounds right. That's right. Because that was our code name for the movie. It was 1984. I graduated high school in 1982. So I must have been 18, 17. I remember it was a big deal. And I definitely remember Terminator 2 because I had just moved to LA and I saw it and it like blew me away. So it was really bizarre. The moment I most remember was when we were shooting a scene, and you know, you usually have a couple of monitors because we had two or three cameras on it, and Arnold was on one camera and Linda Hamilton was on another camera, and I'm like, holy fucking shit, I'm shooting a Terminator movie. But the rest of the time I wasn't thinking about it because I was so busy just trying to not fuck it up, that you just don't have time.
How do you not fuck up Terminator? How do you?
Well, our movie didn't do very well, so clearly I don't have a good answer.
It didn't do very well.
But I'm very proud of it. And Natalia, I got to tell you guys, I know I'm supposed to, you think I'm going to supposed to say this, but she is fucking amazing. She is the best actor I've ever worked with, I got to say. She's just amazing. She's so good. I could literally say, cue the tear, left eye, go. And she would, she's so good, so good.
When you say that the movie didn't do very well, you're talking about money, or are you talking about the fact that just...
What else is there, my friend? It's all about money. Money is the way everybody rates your success, yeah. Though, it's not entirely true. Like, if I had done a shitty film that also didn't make money, I'd probably never get a chance to make another project again. But we did a good film that didn't make money, and so I didn't have to go to director jail. It was more like director timeout a little bit. But
when you look at, do you watch your movies? You know, like do you watch Terminator once again? Like do you stumble
every once in a while? But yeah? I watched it again recently, but I hadn't watched it for a year or so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what's your take now that you watched it?
Oh, it's hard. It's hard to watch your own stuff, I'm sure you know. But have this weird thing where every other time, when you're in post on the movie, you watch it a lot, right? And every other time, I've talked to other directors who have the same experience. Every other time I watch the movie, I hate it. And I think, oh my God, my career's fucking over. This is terrible. None of this works. It all seems fake. I hate it. And then the next time I watch it, I go, oh, that's pretty good. I like that scene. That's pretty good. You know?
Would you do anything different to it?
Terminator?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we made some mistakes. I think the thing that people complained about, I think, is valid, which is... I think it was too much like the predecessors. I think we could have been more different.
More adventurous, perhaps?
More adventurous, yeah. I wanted Natalia's character to be more Obama than General Patton, you know?
Okay.
And someone who is a great leader, but not necessarily leads with a gun. Things like that, I think we could have made it a little different and still been true to the franchise, but made it fresh again, but we didn't.
How'd you meet David Fincher? I've been a fan of David Fincher for a long time because of the music videos that he made. He made Vogue, he made Judith by a Perfect Circle, and you know, I've always had this obsession with him being this music movie, this music video director, because obviously he's a great filmmaker, like you said, and like it's known. But
he's one of the funniest guys you'll ever meet, too.
How'd you
usually
meet
him? At your expense, but he's very funny. My company, Blur, you can go to our website, www.blur.com. We do a lot of video game work, and we always have, which is a great thing. When we started the company, I didn't really want to do commercials because I hate that industry. I'd done it before, and not if any of you do commercials, it's fine. I just didn't like it. I didn't really want to do a lot of film effects either because I wanted to make the decisions. And when you're doing film effects, a lot of the decisions are made by the director, obviously. But then we stumbled into this game market making cinematics, and it's cool because people come and they go, here's some money, here's what the game is, make a cool story. I'm summing up a lot of work, but anyway, it's pretty good, and we got to tell stories, and I really like that. So when I met David, we had kind of become a company that was known for doing these game cinematics that sort of told you dramatic tellings about the game. And David had an idea to make a game at one point in the heyday of where games were in Hollywood were trying to merge, and he wanted to make a game that was, what happens if a 12.0 earthquake hit Los Angeles and you were a delivery boy trapped in an elevator and you had to get out and save people or not save people. So somebody said, oh, you want to do a proof of concept, you should go talk to these guys at Blur. And so they brought David down to Blur, and he liked the way we ran the company, and for some reason we became friends. And he said, well, let me help you. You want to direct, I'll help you. It was great.
Let me go back to Deadpool. I have a clear recollection of the very first time I saw Deadpool in a comic book. It must have been the 14th issue of Spider-Man, drawn by Todd McFarlane. And it was a crossover of titles. It was the X-Force and the
Spider-Man.
It was
Mark Liefeld, wasn't it?
Rob invented that. And yeah. Fabian Nicieza.
You saw him the first time.
First time I actually saw him in a comic book was in that storyline that merged the Spider-Man comic book with the X-Force comic book, which was like it was like the 9th or 10th installment. I mean, Rob was just beginning to create this new young blood of X-Men. And I was so drawn to him by the dark humor, you know. And when Deadpool came out, I was so impressed by how you were able to translate that personality of that villain to life. It was amazing, because I think one of the hardest parts about adaptations is to nail the personality of a comic book character down as perfectly as you did with Deadpool. I think it's one of the greatest achievements in, you know, comic book storytelling.
Well, I appreciate that, but I can't take credit for it, really, because I think the comic book was inspired by characters in cinema to some degree, and Ryan Reynolds was kind of perfect, right? He embodied that character so much so that the comic book creators saw they used Ryan in some of his comedy as sort of a basis as the character developed. So Ryan is Deadpool, and he is the perfect person to play that. And the writers did a fucking fantastic job. Like, when I came on, they had a really great script. I worked on it with them for quite a while, but it was great when I got there. So they really found the tone, and Ryan is sort of the perfect character to play.
How many comic books do you have to, Deadpool comic books, read?
I collect comic books, so I'm a nerd, and I read comic books, and I read Deadpool. But I think the job there as a director is to get the fuck out of the way of good material, right, and just be true to it. I think I did a good job. I'm proud of it. But I also started with great material, and Ryan was born to play that role, you know?
Another thing that I find important.
I could have fucked it up. You could say that. I could be proud that I didn't fuck it up.
How could you have fucked it up?
Very proud that I. You can fuck it up. It's so easy to fuck it up.
But and here's another thing. I mean, the spirit of the movie, which is sort of like this gory storyline.
It's not that
could have been a problem for its commercial success in the end, because it could have felt like a B movie kind of thing, like one of those Steven Seagal or Chuck Norris flicks of the 80s.
Well, I can tell you that the first time we did the makeup, full makeup for Ryan, I'm not going to say who, but there were people involved in the movie that saw that, and I said, oh, it's fucking amazing. It's so cool. It looks so great. And these people took me aside and they said, Tim, we have to do an intervention here. You can't be serious. You can't put that makeup on Ryan. He's Ryan Reynolds and now he looks hideous. We thought you were going to do like a Scar or some, you know, like Sergeant Barnes in Platoon. And I'm like, are you serious? No. The whole plot is driven by this character being too ashamed of how he looks, that so ashamed that he leaves the woman he loves because he doesn't want to be the burden on her, because he's so hideous. The whole plot is driven by how hideous he's become. And if it's just a scar, it's not meaningful. He's vain and arrogant instead of a tragic character. The Phantom of the Opera that isn't mutilated would not be an interesting character. So anyway, they said, well, you can't do it. We don't. This is terrible. You're going to ruin the movie. And I said, no, I'm doing it. That's where the not fucking up part comes in, see? You go, no, I'm going to do this. This is the right way to do it. While not knowing if I'm right, because, as you say, it's a little scary that you're going to take Ryan, who is handsome, and make him ugly for most of the movie.
Did Fox say anything when you pitched the movie? Did they say, let's go for it? I mean, what was their reaction? I mean,
well, no, that was the problem originally. But like, that's why it takes, that's where the perseverance thing comes in, right? So the movie had already been tried by multiple directors to get going, and then as a Hail Mary, they let me try because it just wasn't happening. And so I developed it, and you develop a movie, and you get a budget, and you have a plan, and then you go and take it to the studio, and you go, this is what I'd like to do. This is the vision. I even had that test, the test that leaked.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a good
Let's
thing.
Talk
yeah.
about that. How
Let's not talk about that.
How does that happen? The test leaks, and then the studio approves. Is that how it goes?
Well, it looks like that, and that was part of it. But what really happened was a bunch of things. One, Fox kind of realized that there was an opportunity to make an R-rated comic book movie, and it would differentiate itself from all the other movies out there. Also, Deadpool is very, it makes fun of other comic book movies, so there had been enough comic book movies by that point to become so that it could be a parody of other comic book movies, which made it work better. And then lastly, you know, we got Simon Kinberg, who was a really great producer, to help and was pushing it. So there was already a little bit of momentum, and then the test leaked, which I know what happened, and I didn't at the time. I know what happened now, and it's a nice little story, but I'm not going to tell you.
Why not? Come on.
No, I'm not going to tell you. But it wasn't me. I'll tell you that. And I didn't find out who it was for 3 years. It wasn't Ryan either. But anyway, it was a thing, and it kind of broke the internet. People saw it and they really liked it. And that was the kind of the final push to get it out there.
You also nailed the eyes pretty well.
Like, we did. But
the eyes opening and closed.
But we did
that's pretty badass.
Thank you. It gives a lot of personality to it. But
and that's the way he is. You know?
But we did that test and that budget, and we got it to a point, and the studio said, "Yeah, we're not going to do it." And so, 5 years of every month, I would write and say, you know, whose dick do I got to suck to get this movie made? And they would not. They just didn't want to do it. And so, until the universe aligned to say to get a yes, you know? It was luck. That's why you just got to stick around until you get lucky.
What about the music? How do you have any saying in the music that's involved in the soundtrack
director,
and stuff?
Yeah, director picks all that.
You picked all the songs that.
Well. Some, but not all. Like Angel of the Morning, that was in the car wreck, that was in the script from day one. Ryan really loves music and old 80s songs in particular, so he and the writers were very involved in that. And then we hired the composer and we supervised. I would say the music is not my strength, so I lean on the expertise of others. The editor, Julian Clark, is really great with music. He's very helpful.
It's a pretty successful story for a debut film, right? I mean,
I don't think it gets any more lucky than I did. That was completely unexpected, and I was very lucky.
Talking about superhero movies, some directors like Martin Scorsese, you know, have lashed out at superhero movies. What's your take on some of these big name directors who say that it's not cinema, that it's not film, and all that stuff?
I don't know why it's even a question. I mean, who cares, right? Anything can be. Any story that people want to see is worth telling. I don't know. I mean, I could see why it becomes a. I mean, you guys might not know this because I didn't, but why that happens with movies, why we get these big tentpole movies and it becomes sort of the death of the small and mid-sized movies, there's a lot of sense to it from a business standpoint, because if you make one successful tentpole movie, the studio makes more money than in all the mid-size and small movies, even if they're successful combined. I mean, it's just ridiculous, right? You could make $1 billion on a single movie, and the whole rest of the slate that you make of small and mid-sized movies will make a couple hundred million, even if they're all successful. And they all take a lot of work, and they're all really hard to do, and et cetera, et cetera. So if you just look at it, movies as a business instead of an art, which on some level, you have to, right? Somebody has to pay for all this shit. And so it is a business, and a lot of people look at it that way, and that's their job. So when you look at it that way, it makes a lot of sense that people want to make big tentpole movies instead of the more story-driven art movies that a lot of us love.
Is there a Marvel comic book character that you would like to do a film about that's not been done yet?
I really wanted to do Taskmaster, who was in the Black Widow film, but I don't think it was done well as it could have been. I think Taskmaster would be fucking awesome.
X-Men?
Oh, yeah, X-Men, of course.
What's your take on X-Men? Why did that not move forward, like, say, for example, the Avengers? It will?
Oh, yeah. Well, Marvel has it back now. They didn't have it for a while. It was Fox that controlled X-Men, which is why Deadpool was part of the X-Men universe. There's a big book of, like, these characters are in this universe, and Fox optioned the X-Men, so they had control of all those characters, like Deadpool. But now, Disney bought Fox, and I think I'm friends with Kevin Feige, but I'm sure they're just waiting, and they're going to make plans to bide their time and come out with a big whole X-Men universe.
Do you have any idea why they fired Mrs. Alonso? Is that her name?
I have no idea. I love Victoria. I've known her for years. She's great. She had a hard job of running all the VFX for all those big movies, which turned into an industry of itself. Marvel really kept a lot of visual effects companies busy for the last, 20 years. I get along great with her. I've always liked her.
Everyone talks well about her, and it's funny that all of a sudden she's not there anymore.
I guess. I tried. Natalia said she'd be a good guest for this festival. So I wrote her, and she just didn't get back to me in time.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about AI.
There's a big subject switch for you.
There's a lot of conversation going on about AI, and actually I also saw in some of your conversations with other journalists, you mentioned the use of deepfake technology and some of the sequences on the Terminator Dark Fate. Where do you see animation headed with the help of artificial intelligence?
Such a big question. I've lived through a couple of revolutions in the animation industry. The biggest one was PCs, personal computers. When I first got into animation, computer animation, you had to have $100,000 to buy a giant workstation, and the software was very expensive. And I kind of came in right at the end of that time when people could buy personal computers and and software that allowed you to do stuff and do it at home. And that's really when I got into it, and I fucking loved it. I spent all my money I had a deal with my wife that I could spend my extra freelance money on computers and comic books. And that's what I did. And so it was this great expansion, because now everybody, instead of just a few people, had access to the tools to make really interesting computer graphics and art. And the excitement I felt about the way the industry was expanding then was palpable. It seemed like every month new shit was coming out. I feel the same way right now with AI. It's a little terrifying, to be honest, because it's changing so fast. I'm sure some of you guys have played with ChatGPT. It's frighteningly cool and good.
Have you played with it?
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What do you ask?
It's a better writer than I am.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. I'm completely serious. And it can write stuff I saw one example the other day where someone said, give me instructions how to remove a peanut butter and jelly sandwich from a VCR in the style of the King James Bible. And it was fucking great. I couldn't have written that in days of work. And it was great, and it did it in 10 seconds. I mean, the speed of it is frightening. I asked it to write a negative review of the movie Deadpool. And then write a positive review of the movie Deadpool.
Did it do it?
It did it, and it was great. And what's more, the negatives, I thought was really interesting as a filmmaker, the negatives were the same things that people, it's gathering information, right? So it was the things that people had said. It was the things that the conversation among the people that didn't like it had said. And it's kind of like takes all that negative negative commentary and tells you, which if you're a filmmaker and you don't want to hear negative stuff, don't do that. But I actually want to hear that. I want to hear what people didn't like, right? Mm. But anyway, and then I see the tools are progressing right now every fucking week.
What's AI going to do for animation? Since, given the fact that you've been in animation through two revolutions, what do you foresee?
I feel like there's going to be a lot of, let me talk big picture for a second.
Sure.
That I feel like there's a lot of stories that I would like to tell, and I know other animators would like to tell, that are just too big and too expensive to tell through animation right now because of the time it takes to do it, the amount of labor that goes into the process. And so there's a whole level of creative country that we can't visit because it's too expensive to go there. I feel like that's now within reach. And so what I think will happen, as would happen with computers, is we went from kind of rudimentary tools used to tell rudimentary stories to very sophisticated tools telling more sophisticated stories. And I think that arc is going to continue. So I'm really excited that I can tell some stories that would have been prohibitively expensive now.
Is there one in your mind that pops up in your mind?
Oh, there's so many. Like, again, sci-fi nerd, fantasy nerd. There's so many books that I would like to tell.
I got one last question to ask you regarding books.
Let me just say the dark side is, if you're an animator, I think there's a basic skill set. Or an artist, right? There's the whole 10,000 hours. You guys have all heard that, right? There's a process of doing stuff that because you love it, but it's kind of grunt work. But that's how you learn. You learn through suffering. If you have a piece of software, I believe that. If you have a piece of software that can animate a human or a cat or a horse, it's hard for you, and it can do it perfectly. How are you ever going to learn? Why is it worth your fucking time to struggle in front of a computer for 2 weeks at night, like I did, trying to make a person walk across the floor because there was no such thing as IK animation, right? But I learned a lot from doing that, and it was terrible. Now I can push a button. Now I can type a sentence that just says character walk across the floor. And what is that going to mean? I mean, yes, it means I can tell bigger stories, but it also means that young animators coming into the business are going to have, it's just going to be different. I don't know. They're going to miss that kind of level of education, but it'll probably be replaced by something I can't even tell you. It'll be a different thing. Different skills will come in that were not allowed to be in, or couldn't be part of the process before.
May you live in interesting times, is what they say.
That's the Chinese curse, right? Yes.
Listen, talking about adaptations, to finish off the conversation, we got to go. Ya nos tenemos que ir, si ya lo sé. But I have a question. Why has Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein never been adapted to film?
Because it's kind of boring.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of boring.
I love that book, man. I want to see that
you
book.
I love that book, too. You know, people write all the time. They're like, why haven't you done I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream? I'm like, because it's depressing. I look for stuff for Love, Death, and Robots that has some scope and some story, that has an interesting twist to it, that could be visually beautiful. And I really like heroes. I like to tell positive stories. There's enough shitty things happening in the world. We don't need more of that. But I do like shitty things that happen so that the hero can overcome them. Or the heroine.
Thank you so much for geeking out with me today. Con toda la gente del nido aquí en el Fixie. It's been a pleasure meeting you, Tim Miller.
Thank you
very much for being at Fixie.
I love your city. It's beautiful. You're very lucky to live
there. Muchas gracias a ustedes por estar en el podcast.